This is Gail Nickel-Kaling, Good Food World. And today we talk with Christopher Leonard, investigative reporter, about his new book, The Meat Racket. Leonard looks closely at one company, Tyson Foods, that developed an entirely new business model, changed an industry, and made billionaires of the family that started it. In the 80 years from the Great Depression, when John Tyson drove 500 chickens from Arkansas to Chicago until today, Tyson Foods has drained small towns across America's South of their vitality and sent uncounted farmers into bankruptcy. There are parallels between Don Tyson, John's son, and Henry Ford. Both were visionaries, both built complex, vertically integrated companies, and both changed industries and American culture. While Ford believed he needed to pay his workers a salary that would allow them to buy his products, Tyson believed that his workers, contract farmers, should be paid through a system where only a few truly benefited from their hard work and the rest were paid as little as possible. We join the conversation now.
To me, the biggest take-home point is that things do not have to be the way they are. That, for example, 100 years ago, we had a meat trust of four big companies that dominated the market the same way the companies do today. And they depressed prices for farmers and they raised prices for consumers. That's what they did 100 years ago. Teddy Roosevelt came in. There was this whole new era with these progressive writers and busting trusts. And those companies were limited in their market power. We busted the trusts. And then we had a very, very competitive, innovative meat system, definitely from the 1940s through the 1970s, that, you know, generated lots of income in rural America and produced some pretty high-quality meat. And then we let it start consolidating again to get to where we are today. So to me, the biggest take-home point is that things don't have to be the way they are, and they can be changed, but it definitely is going to take willpower to change them. And I think that's part of the reason why Obama has not been able to do anything effective on this issue was, you know, he brought in a lot of pretty intelligent people and they were looking at this. And you're right, it's very hard to get in and start tearing apart a supply chain and start tinkering with giant companies once they're already up and running and doing business. The real original sin was letting these companies buy each other out and letting massive consolidation happen in the 70s and 80s and 90s. That's where we took a real wrong turn, was we forgot the lessons of market structure, that it's really kind of not okay to have four companies make 85% of one product, which in this case would be beef, and think that they're not going to use their monopolistic power. So now that they've gotten it, it's a much harder lift to do something about it. There are big things you can do, like literally breaking up Tyson Foods into smaller regional players that would be mini Tysons, the same way we did to AT&T back in the 1980s. That's going to be a heavy lift. There are smaller things to do in the interim, like banning Tyson's tournament system for farmers. I don't want to go on too long about that, but it's a system whereby farmers are ranked against each other and paid based on how they ranked against each other. And they're ranked against each other, so half do well and half don't do well. It's a really Machiavellian, horrible system. And the reason why I know we don't need to do it is because hog farmers under contract in Iowa don't have to play in the tournament. And people are still making money just fine up in Iowa. It doesn't have to be this way. So there are reforms like that that we could probably start working on in the next few years that would really help farmers and bring more transparency to the market.
How would you envision that these communities that were depressed by the vertical integration would reestablish themselves? Is the end of the tournament one way? What else do they need to do?
See, you're bringing up a really good point because there are major structural issues here. As we talked about, you've got a town like Waldron, Arkansas that's producing poultry and it's big business, right? Millions of dollars in income. It used to be that there would be a local feed mill, a local hatchery, a local slaughterhouse. In Iowa, you still have some towns where that is the case, where these are still actually independently owned businesses and you have small business owners keeping their earnings from them. Under a vertically integrated system of the kind Tyson runs, all those businesses are sucked into the silo of one corporation's control, the vortex. So how do you turn that around and start changing it? We talk about banning the tournament or taking other antitrust efforts that would give farmers more leverage and bring more transparency to the market. One thing that that would do is put more money in the pockets of people in these towns, which is always a good thing. I've interviewed lots of farmers in lots of small towns, and to a person, they're there because they love that community. if they didn't love the community, they would certainly have gone to a big city and gotten a job at an office somewhere. It's a fair bet that if you give these farmers more rights and create, you know, shift the balance of power a little bit so they're not under the thumb of a regional monopoly as they are today, they would have more money in their pockets at least, that, which they could spend on Main Street and make things more economically viable in that sense. But then how you, like, actually get down to the deep down structural issues, look, I'll just be honest, that is outside my lane. I am not a policymaker. I'm not a planner. I'm just a journalist describing what's happening out there. I'd like to hear a debate. Would it be smarter to break up Tyson Foods and have those businesses be independent again? Or are there other measures that could help, you know, stimulate more growth in rural America?
The number of independent slaughterhouses out there is a huge problem. Were you able to see any small slaughterhouses, or are they all completely gone?
They're not all completely gone, but you're right. It's a huge problem, and there are so many different elements to it. So during the 70s and 80s, we saw the rise of the mega beef plant, and that did wipe out a lot of the smaller, independent, even mid-sized, I mean, not mom-and-pop, but mid-sized slaughterhouses. So it's another symptom of this massive consolidation, that all the beef slaughtering has migrated to these mega, mega meat plants that are highly regulated by USDA, as you know, and you've got to have those USDA inspectors on hand. So it's a barrier to competition. And I hear repeatedly all the time from small producers that there aren't enough, you know, small to mid-sized slaughterhouses to go to. But we're just at this kind of stagnant point right now where an investor with a lot of money, why would they build a small to mid-sized slaughterhouse unless they're really sure that there's going to be a small viable local market to support it and some giant company's not going to come in and wipe out their market by undercutting them on price? Mm-hmm. When you have consolidation like this, it can create this sort of self-reinforcing barriers to entry that make it really hard for new people to enter the market. You know, I do think that there's some interest in USDA in working on some kind of new inspection regime that would be friendlier to smaller slaughterhouses, like mobile slaughterhouses or things like that, that could help you know, creating more options. And you can see that again and again, that there was this really vibrant market around meat in the 60s and 70s that has been wiped out. And I don't just mean like butcher's jobs, but a big part of what I write about is the destruction of transparent markets. For example, with hogs. Hogs used to be traded really vigorously on an open market where the price was like the price of a share of IBM stock. Everyone could see it, it moved up and down, and it helped create price discovery. In other words, people could, you know, realize the accurate price of a hog. That's what kind of free markets and capitalism is all about. But the rise of contract hog production dismantled and destroyed that competitive, open, transparent market. So now there's no way to discover the price of a hog. You don't have buyers and sellers going back and forth over a price. And these companies do set their price. So the price is more determined by the company's power instead of the actual value of the animal.
I was really interested in your discussion of the move Tyson made in the mid-90s into fish, or didn't make. Why do you think it didn't work?
I think it didn't work because it didn't fit their basic business model, which was being able to control animal production from the very, very beginning, from the genetics. For example, with chickens, they own the breeding company that breeds the best hens, then they own the egg, then they hatch it at a hatchery, they ship it out to a farmer who they control through a contract, they bring it back to the slaughterhouse and ship it out to McDonald's. Very similar model for hogs. With fish, you still have to go out and catch the fish. I know that there's a lot more farm-raised salmon or things like that, but back in the 90s when Tyson was getting into this, there was still this element of having to go out and catch it that was sort of an open-ended intersection with nature almost. And so without that really tight control there, it just didn't fit their business model.
Do you think high-end meats like organic and grass-fed or identity-preserved and estate beef is a way that these small businesses can come back? Or is the market just too small?
I do think it's a great way for small businesses to come back. The market is small now today, but it is pretty vibrant, and more people are becoming conscious about their food, and more people are understanding the value of knowing your farmer, giving the money directly to the person who raises the animal. I think actually I would say it's a really great way for somebody young who wants to get into the business to get into it, is to kind of use that model. I'll be honest, I've been looking so much at these big guys and what they've been doing that I don't know how much money there is to be made, you know, entering in today as a small person. But it seems like one of the more vibrant parts of the market where you actually have innovation and more competition. And I'm sure, as you know, the key is connecting directly to the consumer. There is a really good market to be had in that, and I think it's growing a lot more all the time. I started writing about this stuff in the late 90s, and people just could care less about food back then, as a rule, and it's really different today.
The few large companies that control poultry, beef, and pork production in the U.S. have a stranglehold on our food system. They sell the American consumer bland meat treated with antibiotics, hormones, and all sorts of chemicals. And in most cases, there's no way to actually tell where that meat came from, especially if you eat prepared food, and especially if you eat fast food. There are alternatives. The first and simplest is to buy organic. Second, buy direct from a farmer or rancher, preferably one you've met personally or could visit if you want it. Third, reduce the amount of meat in your diet, adding fish and plant protein. Knowing where your food comes from, eating a primarily plant-based diet, and limiting the amount of processed food you consume is better for you, better for the animals, and better for the environment. The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, written by Christopher Leonard and published by Simon & Schuster, is available from independent bookstores on the street and online at indiebound.org. That's one word, I-N-D-I-E-B-O-U-N-D, or at Amazon.com.